Hello, creeps. I'll be your ghost. I mean host. As we delve the crypts of spooky movies and even spookier theory, welcome to Horror Vanguard. Hello, listeners, and welcome to a very special, very wishful episode of Horror Vanguard. I am one of your co-ghosts, Ashley Darrow, joined, as always, by John, aka the Liquor Guy. How is it going today, John?
I don't know where I am. I don't know what's going on. I feel like so much of this has happened to me already, but I don't think I've learned anything from it.
Listeners, John and I may have made an Irish wish earlier, and we are now experiencing a lost time phenomenon. And we have learned absolutely fucking nothing in the intervening magical session that we had. But we are, you know what, we're not alone today, because we Irish wished ourselves a third co-ghost. You know him, you love him, the legendary, most returning guest of Horror Vanguard, Kyle Kern! How's it going, Kyle?
I have returned to the bench in which I wished to... start co-hosting the podcast, but I'm not going to lie. I don't think St. Bridget is going to show up. So unfortunately, I think everyone's stuck with me. We did experience a time-altering, body-switching type incident earlier, but I think we're back. But yeah, I also have not learned that I need to live my destiny. So I'm afraid we're going to just have to do everything again.
I have not learned a lesson. I will never learn a lesson. I will never experience character growth. I will only ever get worse.
My fits more atrocious. Yeah, I mean, I'm gonna go to Ireland, and I'm gonna fall in love with exclusively people from the UK. I think that's what I learned from this film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's why I think it's a colonial movie. Like, that's.
Listeners, wet your lips on this discourse. We are going to have so much fun today, or by the end of this episode, it's just going to be like completely like anti-cogent wailing that infects your mind. This is a cognito hazard is what we're putting together today.
The ranks there is the now... Vanguard grow ever more terrifyingly.
There is now pre-Kernite and post-Kernite Horror Vanguard listeners, so we mm-hmm. have two eras. And to celebrate your glorious joining of a podcast, we are going back, we are returning with a V to the films that started it all. Lindsay Lohan's body-swapping cinema, Criterion Collection-worthy cinema. And we want to thank you for doing this, Kyle. You have unlocked magic. Freaky Friday will happen. But before we get that far, John, this is technically a rom-com.
Yeah.
So could you tell us what today's movie is all about?
I would love to. I think I just stepped into a James Joyce novel. In 2001... Remedy Entertainment released the video game Max Payne. It followed a film noir cliche who came to life. A metaphor spouting heavy drinking, quick shooting New York City cop out for revenge, and a dangerous dame who, out of all the gin joints in all the towns in all the world, walked into his. What made Max Payne stand out was its formulaic structure. Every fight, every cliche of speech meticulously acted out again and again. You can see every bullet coming. Max doesn't have freedom, of course. He knows what's happening to him. He knows he's in a video game. How does he put it? The truth was burning green crack through my brain. Weapon statistics hanging in the air just out of the corner of my eye, endless repetition of the act of shooting, the paranoid feel of someone controlling my every step. I was in a computer game, funny as hell. It was the most horrible thing I could think of. What would happen to any of us if we realized we were trapped in a story and we knew how it would unfold? I think I just stepped into a James Joyce novel. Funny as hell. It's the most horrible thing I can think of. Max is in love, trapped there, endlessly repeating the same gestures of desire and loss. Don't we all want this, to be in love, to see the pattern of love play out for us? So familiar, endlessly repeating, unfolding ad infinitum until all of history and subjectivity becomes a series of infinitely repeating gestures. All art is, in a way, mediated repetition. Does it set us free? Does love? The libidinal jouissance of love, of eros, is suspended between knowing the end and wanting, needing the delicious agony of the end's deferment. I feel like I've just stepped into a James Joyce novel. Funny as hell. It's the most horrible thing I could think of. Maddie is in love, and in love we find ourselves condemned to act out something we can't help but think we've seen before. Time is out of joint, says Hamlet. What? Has the ghost appeared again? I've been here before. I feel like I've just stepped into a James Joyce novel. Funny as hell, the most horrible thing I can think of. Nietzsche, the gay science. What if some day or night a demon were to steal after you into your loneliest loneliness and say to you, this life as you now live it and have lived it, you will have to live once more and innumerable times more, and there'll be nothing new in it but every pain and every joy and every thought and every sigh, and everything unutterably small or great in your life will return to you all in the same succession and sequence. Even this spider and this moonlight between the trees, and even this moment, would you not throw yourself down and gnash your teeth and curse Saint Bridget and beg, please unwish my wish? Amor fati, love your fate, said Nietzsche, but this film shows us not a vision of the homecoming of love in which the gestures of love pre-remembered are confirmed within us as we come to Heimat, the utopian space in which we realize we could have become what we always wanted. As long as reality is not completely closed off, then no objection to utopia can be raised by purely factual reality. And so to wish is not to do. It is not to live. Max Payne could never put down his gun. Maddie can never be somewhere other than thinking, just stepped into a James Joyce novel. Gestures so repeated they've become meaningless. A liquefaction of culture so stunningly complete that entire countries vanish, boiled into nothing but a few gestures. Ireland does not exist, all subsumed into the authentic simulacra of the romantic comedy industrial complex. I think I've just stepped into a James Joyce novel. Funny as hell. It's the most horrible thing I could think of. What to do then with these gestures so endlessly commodified, so soaked in the paranoia of focus group refined algorithmic content, they've become dissonant phrases. We must make a demand of these gestures. We must restore the terrifying possibility of love that can unmake and remake and redefine human existence into something so new as to be unrecognizable. As a great Irish writer and revolutionary put it, all the way back in 1907, some men, faint-hearted, ever seek, are programmed to retouch, and will insist whene'er they speak that we demand too much. 'Tis passing strange, yet I declare, such statements give me mirth, for our demands most moderate are, we only want the earth. Join us.
Oh, that is so good. That is
I was debating between finishing the Praetie with James Connolly or a quote from James Joyce's short story The Dead. I think I made the right choice.
You made the right choice. Let's start as we always do in the unified 32 counties of the formalism zone. This episode is gonna be so hard.
Okay, I feel like you're completely right, but we have to explore that this is the most like all deeply conservative culture. It exists at the intersection of like political fascism and pornography. Because this is a film that is like utterly obsessed and at the same time completely terrified and disgusted by the idea of sexual desire.
Yes.
Genuinely amazing moment where she, Maddie realizes she's going to marry the person that this extremely British sounding Irish novelist. Gets into bed with her quote unquote fiance, who touches her arm, so she like beats him up so badly he breaks his dick. Yeah, and like describing what happens, people are going to think like I'm exaggerating, but that is precisely like it's this deep mixture of like you can only mediate desire through the institution of marriage, but it can never admit any possibility of sex. But at the same time, the sexual desire is all like just teeming away under the surface. I feel like it should be stated that that Kyle has form in this area. Not only, you know, Lindsay Lohan visiting professor of Eldritch Horror, but also responsible for us talking about Boss Baby.
I don't
want to overstate this, but this is worse. And you have brought there's something deeply evil and horrifyingly fascist about this film.
Like Boss Baby is, it's a bad trip. It's a productive nightmare. You know, it changed me for the worse, but at least I could still change. This movie, like Freaky Friday, is a fucked up fetish movie, and Irish Wish is just, God, I've never felt so like nothing, not even sedate. I'm excited.
You're at the end of time. You have lived a full life full of love and joy and companionship, and now you are stuck at the airport tripping over everything and running into people that you don't like, and they aren't getting you the ticket that you need to get to your daughter's wedding, and you're actually in a purgatorial forever state of falling down, which is something that people do a lot in this movie. And if you're familiar with weird rom-com tropes, you know that women be falling. That is the rom-com trope. But in this movie, everyone falls down all the time. There's almost no idea. Everyone falls down or breaks out into spontaneous combat at random moments. You can't predict it. It's so profoundly mundane, yet incredibly libidinal, which I think is what everything that's been sort of leading up to now has come to. Like, that's sort of the point that we've been talking around, both in this and other lives before we made wishes to Irish saints / genies. Because let's face it, Saint Bridget, who, as we talked about before recording, kind of serves a little bit.
I have to say, kind of the only one who does in the film, because,
yeah.
The stylist and costume design work is truly awful for most of the entire film. Like Lindsay,
everybody else,
yeah. Lindsay gets like one or two nice looks, which is not enough in this movie.
Like plaid.
This would have been the perfect film for just ultra cunt Lindsay Lohan Irish fits, perfect, elegant, slutty. Just keep churning them all out. Classic.
Put her in a sexy balaclava.
We got them all. Just yes, yes. There we go. 100%. Plaid skirt, balaclava in my closet right now. Like these are the fits that we're talking about. And in this, it's the most like moth-eaten Macy's sale rack stuff. And I think it speaks to the general anhedonia we witnessed today.
Yeah, it's like the a catalog come to, or the film inside of the catalog. Is that this film is inside of something else. We're just trying to figure out, we've been trying for now several days to figure out what dreamt up this movie. Is it a cosmic computer that's never seen a human or a film before, that like only sees everything through like this weird astrological mirror? Is it the dream of someone who had a tragic keg-related accident in Boston on St. Patrick's Day and went into a coma? is it the purgatorial metaphor, the generative AI metaphor? This movie has layers. That's one thing that I'll give it.
Maybe we should dig into that more.
I'll take that back.
The AI it has, vibe.
Yeah, I'll take that back. It has one very weird layer. It's much more like a quilt than it is an onion, you know? Like, it just has these kind of various ideas stitched together. It has all of the tropes of, like, the kind of Christmassy, mostly Christmassy, but, you know, the general Hallmark rom-com thing or whatever, but without a story and also this weird fixation with the idea of the Bolivian tree lizard. Which feels like it's pulled from a robot scraping the internet, right? Like, and also it's in the lost archive of the alternative universe, non-wish version of this episode. But I think this movie really thinks that Irish people don't know what lizards are. They very, they very softly suggest on a couple of occasions that like this lizard thing or whatever you're talking about. It's like, do they not know what reptiles are in this movie?
No. They don't.
No, that's the sequel where Lindsay Lohan makes a wish with St. Patrick, and we learn why there are no lizards in Ireland. It's more than snakes. Lindsay Lohan wishes for no lizards in Ireland, and it's just a very complicated political message. That's extremely right wing.
Yeah, I was about to say, but the one thing that's clear is that it's right wing. I think y'all zeroed in on it already, but it is just all very right wing, I think.
Yeah, it is that, and this ties into the AI thing, is because it like, okay, so like, I know we don't talk a lot about like the technicalities of filmmaking on the show, but like genuinely watch this if you want to learn about like film editing, because watching this movie just feels it feels wrong. It feels like time is just kind of like it feels like you're blacking in and out of consciousness watching this movie, because editing and continuity like change so rapidly that your brain literally can't process what it's seeing.
It's like that thing that they do, that technique where they take two images and generate one video image with the pixels of the other video image. They do it in like music videos and stuff like that. It honestly feels that way, because that's where my real tinfoil hat hours come out. And I think like, who edited this movie? Someone with an IMDb page with credits for The Nutty Professor and I'm trying to remember another really bad movie. Very funny movie, like Norbit or something like that. No, it's not Norbit. It's another, you know, romp of sort. Some like, you know, bad comedy that made a lot of money. I don't know if Norbit made money, but the like it jumps around, and it's not even just like the story's incoherent and everything. But you're sitting in a scene, and then two people are in dialogue with each other, and it jumps back and forth so often. And then it jumps over the shoulder of other people that you wonder, like, how many cameras did they have in the room and how many times did they shoot this scene? They cannot have gotten too many takes of everything doing.
I think they were one and done for all the principal photography, and the editor is basically like using B-roll and cutaways and is desperate.
We got shoulder doubles aplenty here. Yeah.
Yeah. Or it's cut together by AI.
It at least feels like it is, These other types of movies like this aren't edited like this. They don't look like this. The Falling for Christmas, which had a lot of the same people who worked on it. I didn't check to see if he edited Falling for Christmas. This so-called human, this so-called person who I'm now convinced doesn't exist and has always been a robot. That, like, I don't, it didn't jump around like this. And also this, the story was different. The dialogue was different. I watched another, some clips of a movie that I've seen before. The Princess Switch with Vanessa Hudgens, it's made its round on like the YouTube React people. And it was another Netflix original, premised on the same kind of like, not super, it's not supernatural in this case, but like secret twins. So it has the same kind of like mystic, like, and combined with like the Christmas magic, which like everything to these people is magic. Like they are like 13th century peasants. Like everything is magic. Everything is like wishes and whatever. Like we can talk about the Freudian wish all we want. And sure, there's some clearly some like, you know, repressed childhood stuff, which is why her mother keeps calling at weird opportune times throughout this movie. The Princess Switch is fits a weird amount of supernatural stuff and weird stuff into 90 minutes. It jumps around so much that like, but it still feels like a movie. This doesn't feel like a movie.
No, and it's like, it just on a really basic level of like setup and payoff of like, how does a film like work? How does visual narrative work? There's like a moment where after they arrive at the castle for the first time in the middle of nowhere, one character goes to the other and goes, let's go out and meet some boys because you've not dated in a year. And then as soon as they finish speaking, they forget what they've just said and nothing happens.
Yeah, they don't do any of the things that they say they're going to do. They just kind of move along with the story, or the story just jumps somewhere else. At one point, remember when they were dancing? I forgot the scene existed. They were dancing to Earth, Wind, and Fire. Mm-hmm. Having a party, like a pre-wedding party or something like that. Did they explain the party? No. Also, Lindsay Lohan's mom lives in Des Moines, Iowa. Is she from Des Moines? Or does her mom is a principal of a high school? We don't know anything about the school. We just know that she's a principal at a high school. It's Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman.
Yeah, except that someone keeps stealing toilet paper.
The children steal toilet paper and she can't stop falling down.
I hope those TikTok teens got a devious lick when they stole all those toilet papers. I'm just fellow kids as I turn my hat back.
Yeah, we stole toilet paper in college out of necessity.
Of course, time-honored tradition. And like we spent like, I don't know, like what, like 4 days collectively in our group chat now trying to figure out like what the hell is going on with this film. And I keep returning to, like, this isn't really a movie. Like, it's got the shape of a movie. I keep thinking of Stab, the movie that's in the background of the later Scream sequels.
Yes.
Like, it doesn't exist. It's not a real movie. It's hollow. It's parodic. But this is, like, this has, like, it's a little polyp of some kind of nightmare that's emerged into our world. It wants to look like human interaction, human dialogue, real places on Earth. But everything has, like, too many knuckle joints, too many fingers in weird places. just a hauntingly bizarre, cryptic little film.
The inn scene, one.
That's Scruffy O'Shaughnessy's or whatever their like extremely not offensive pub name.
Yeah, we were talking that like
I'm so sorry.
To try and make sense of this film is to slowly be driven insane, because like the worst thing about human subjectivity and human psychology, and it's something that actually explains a lot of conspiracy theorists, is that you start, when you have an incomplete picture of something, you try and find coherence in it. And like this is like cinematic QAnon. Like trying to understand this film, if you look at it too long, you're suddenly going to be like decoding the number of fibers in the plaid dress, or why does she get changed into like a twin set and pearls at one point? What is happening?
Look, and you all realize I know at the end of this movie, is that Brushy Bill Roberts was Billy the Kid, and this is a true thing. Sheriff Pat Garrett never shot him. He shot an unrelated man, that coward, and I know Lindsay Lohan proves this to me.
She told me.
She told me. It's in the fibers in her dress, John. She knows.
Yeah.
What does the apple pie mean? What does it mean?
So the apple pie, undue American influence, American appropriation of Irish politics. God, I'm trying so hard. Lindsay Lohan has like an incomplete appraisal of Ireland, almost like she's six counties short of being a full something. I can't work through this entirely.
Bolivian tree lizard. Trees are in parks. And the park is where... Yeah, I think I see what you mean. The references don't have... It doesn't have... When it does reference thing, it doesn't usually reference much. It references its own logic, and that logic is like laundered through this kind of unrequited love story about living your destiny. She literally says, it's maybe my favorite line in the movie, is when she gets to the end and she wants to undo everything that's happened, and Saint Bridget shows up and she says, I want to take my wish back. And she says, well, that's not how it works. And she says, but I learned my lesson. I have to live my own destiny. And she goes, oh, well, then that's different. And then just undoes everything. She literally says, I've learned my lesson. I have to live my own destiny. Which, again, even for like, There's another like sort of AI dialogue filler scene that I like right after the very violent wedding confrontation where everyone starts beating each other up for seemingly no reason.
It's an Irish wedding. This movie's very sensitive culturally.
None of these people are really Irish. I'm convinced of that. Not just in the way that they're loyalist trash. But in the fact
you mean
that
all of their British accents didn't throw you off?
the most British Irish people you've ever seen in your entire life. But they jump from like scenes of comedic like violence to like extreme confessions of like we're destined to be together, to like inexplicable rejection. Again, the Bolivian tree lizards. Is like he's a nature photographer, but they only sometimes gesture to it. Oh, did you like it when he was taking pictures of her on the cliff and then she kind of glances at the viewfinder and then says, hey, you're pretty good. she points at that. I don't know, now I'm rambling.
That's the only way you can talk about this, because everything that we say in isolation sounds made up.
Yeah.
Like when they go to the pub and recreate the Titanic jig scene.
Yes, like, that is the Titanic scene. That's right.
Oh, photograph me like one of your Kildare girls, Lindsay Lohan says. No, like I am so dead convinced that a month from now we're all gonna wake up with like elaborate obsidian shrines at the city center of every major metropolitan area on Earth, and it's going to be because of this damn movie. Like, and I think like so we're I can't remember if this is like listeners, we had a we made a technical mishap wish. We used the wrong Catholic saint, and we lost a bit of audio earlier. But like we were talking about desire in this movie, and I think like there's total anhedonia here. It's just going through the motions. And like we get a scene towards the end where they're at the cliffs of Moher, and it's beautiful and it's windswept and it's ocean. And like fucking Lindsay Lohan is like, I am writing a book on the cliffs of Moher. It just delivers that line like speech to text or text to speech.
Yeah.
And like this whole time she's been like, oh, I'm an author. I'm going to write books. I've been ghostwriting all these romance novels. And now she's going to write like, the way she phrases it makes it seem like she's writing like a geological survey of the cliffs and not like I'm going to write a romance here set with a wayward author and a hot photographer. Like there's no passion. There's no direction.
Yeah. This is a movie that is
again, it's as with all conservative art, is fascist and pornographic, it's so, you're right, it's like I've never taken Ambien. I've never done that. it's very difficult to get, but I have seen this movie and I get it now. I get all of those Reddit posts which are like, I'm gonna take Ambien, nothing's gonna happen, lol. Then 3 hours later, why are batteries in my remote so loud? I understand that now. I feel like we're not like expressing the true like horror of this, because right, it's a very obvious critical move to be like, oh, the romance genre is heteronormative, mm-hmm. reactionary, blah blah blah. Yes, that's fine, that's true. But actually, there is something about this. There is something I think that's worth paying attention to its formal structure and to like its emotive or affective content as being potentially like worth noting and excavating as a, for a leftist culture. But it's like, you try and dig underneath something here and you fall into the void. You fall into like, this is where affect goes to be annihilated. Like nobody here likes anybody, because liking is an emotion and that just doesn't exist in this place.
Yeah, there's no, it has this post-ideological, thus incredibly ideological slant, I think is just going to continue to get more intense as time goes on, because there's no longer, I've been thinking about this in terms of culture, the usual sort of like, and a lot of this is in retrospect, so it grants you a certain perspective, but there used to be this in popular culture, especially pop music, and some films and stuff too, but there used to be this kind of spoken agreement in an understanding of the like kind of composite figure that you're taking into. I watched the 2012 Katy Perry documentary, Part of Me, which fun fact is when she made a music video where literally on a Marine base where she breaks up with a guy and joins the Marines. there, she represents this kind of like, she was like one of the last really big pop stars to where you could see the sort of composite corporate effort and you just kind of accept it. It's the transition into a personality in a really sort of like what I think is a really bad way. This emphasis on, you know, everyone is your best friend, my close personal friend, insert this person here. which everyone accepts that the like person that you're looking at is the result of like, no one can do all of that stuff by themselves. If you're a billion-dollar pop star, you're not a singular figure. You are a composite image of a litany of collaborators. But not only do we understand that and accept it, but now we act to an extreme in terms of our performance in, say, defense of that person on the internet or something like that. We've entered into this like way, this form of cultural supremacy that's going to take this type of dry, affected, but still very deeply ideologically right-wing form of media and is going to continue to just kind of encourage subjective experience to be grounded in these performances that are like, yeah, it's not, you know, it's not your grandma's like sexism, but it's still in there. And guess what? It's also racist. Like it just they maybe not in the way that you expected. You know, we do continue to be surprised by the banality of the things that we see, but I don't know how much longer we can continue to be surprised by things like this and before it becomes this even more foundationally constructive apparatus that like, it's a, It's the foundation of subjectivity borne by media apparatuses, which is the affliction of our contemporary moment. Like, this is how people live their lives and build themselves and can, like, identify themselves. So what if they start identifying themselves with the composite constructions of a fucking computer? Because that's what this feels like it is. It's not just that culture is bad. It's that, what is it telling people about themselves? And, like, this is... I don't know what to say. You know,
you're so spot on with that one, because like with this film, like we could talk about like the misogyny of like rom coms from like 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, you know, where it's like, you're a dame, you can't be a book author. Right. But then you have this movie where Lindsay Lohan is just like, implicitly, I can't be a book author. Why am I saying that so weird? This movie's infecting me. Please send help. But like she's so cowed and so broken, and like she is so unrooted in her grand ambition to write some kind of story that she's like, I'm going to write a book about some cliffs with like no direction, no thought. And she's not even like, so the kind of like the are like roguish, the shape of this movie would have the author that she wants to marry as a dashing, womanizing rogue. But he's kind of just a feckless, banal dork. And like, you know, so he's been stealing Lindsay Lohan's book ideas this entire time, passing them off on his own. And he's become like J.K. Rowling for rom-coms, I guess, is who this guy is. Yeah. And like, at no point is Lindsay like, you stole my fucking book ideas, you're going down. Like, she doesn't care. She's like, oh, yeah, you stole my book ideas, that's great, we can still be friends. Like everything is so diaphanous and without commitment in this film.
I think really the key phrase to what both of you are saying is like, the hollowing out of experience is the kind of mark of, so like if neoliberal capitalism is predicated upon maximizing rent extraction, right? Everything has to be commodified and mediated through a platform that allows you to take rents. But what that does is it like hollows out the qualitative human subjective experience from the world and returns it into the realm of like the quantified market exchange, right? Everything becomes hollow. All that is sacred is profaned, right? And we are kind of like, you see us reaching the end of that process. Like, where else can we go? Can we go into culture? No, because books are now simply the commodity that, and it doesn't matter if you steal my ideas, because the computer generates the ideas now. You know, can we go into cultural exchange? No, because this entire country does not exist. It's become a prop.
Yes.
It's become this thing that's designed to sell flights from Des Moines to like that you'll never be able to get on. Right? Can we go into history? No, because history doesn't exist anymore. So like the key word is like the thing that's so like utterly like genuinely like curlingly terrifying about this film is that if you just push ever so slightly, there's like hollow nothingness. There's like profoundly nihilistic underneath it all. Because it just goes, look, there's the gesture, right? There's the, look, oh, we did the kiss with the camera spinning around. Like, there you go. There you go. And like, the thing this made me think about was Singing in the Rain. Singing in the Rain is kind of a perfect movie, right? It's genuinely perfect. If you've not seen it in a while, go watch it. It's just amazing. I used to teach Singing in the Rain as an introduction to genre for undergraduate film students. And it's like, they would come in at 9 a.m. on a Monday looking really grumpy. And then you put on Singing in the Rain. And it's like, it's genuinely impossible to like not love the movie if you watch it on a big screen, right? Impossibly romantic film as well, by the way. But that's a film that is like basically about the mediation of human relationships through media apparatus, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's about the talkies. But even there, there is that, what does that media apparatus allow you to do is to actually get like to experience something that can't be quantified within it, right? How does it end? It's like, stop that woman right at the end. When she runs out of the theater, away from the media apparatus. But in this, the media is all there is. The image is the only thing. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't, there is no romance now, because romance is more than an image, and the rest is just gone.
It's Singing in the Rain is very much about our ability to catch up and interpretation's ability to catch up with technological progress. Because mm-hmm. just as you're describing, at the end, it's revealed that the Lena Lamont character is the true voice is hidden behind the curtain.
Yeah.
And so the real magic is actually happening someplace else and can be revealed with scrutiny. And when that is revealed, it's humorous. What does everyone do? They laugh. I fucking love Singing in the Rain. You unlocked my secret dialogue tree. Like, I had a crush on Gene Kelly for 25 years or whatever. Like, the promise of the idea behind this change is that those elements of those narrativized and literary elements of human experience can be realized and portrayed in some new or interesting way. Yeah. And it's what results in this sense of intimacy that people have with movies, this how movies inspire their own sense of creative expression and end up spiraling off into this, like, you know, like now we're sitting on a movie where they're Singing in the Rain, which was a period film when it was made. And now we're sitting on a podcast about a different genre talking about Singing in the Rain, however many years later. But what happens when it all gets crushed into this, again, one very flat layer, pounded out as thin as possible, just to, like, it's a new digital, like, fetishized object that is so, like, potent that it speaks to you, but not in the good way. You know, like, you have to, like, objects have to be, like, brought to speech, but when they're talking at you already, like, I think that represents something really very, very bad,
to use a technical term. This film hates the viewer. This film hates the viewer.
Oh, yes.
Like, Singing in the Rain thinks that you are, as an audience member, thinks that you are, you deserve, like, something that's going to be entertaining, but also something that is going to, like, spark something within you. Because, as a work of art, it recognizes that there is something within you that is, like, beyond the quantification of visual representation. But, like, this film, Irish Wish, hates you. Absolutely. Like, you are a shell. You are completely empty of dreams or desires or soul. You are the blank canvas into which it will pour this, like, sickly concentrated acidic nihilism that will kind of boil away everything interesting within you.
So this film is pretty miserable, I would say. But I do find something about this, like, there's something going on in kind of, like, the meta-perceptual space of Irish Wish that I want to, like, throw to the group here. Because, like, we're right about everything we've said about this movie. It's colonial, it's racist, it's misogynistic, it's incredibly bleak and hypocritic and dark about the fate and path of contemporary human societal effort. Artistic production, this is just the most The Machine made a movie I have ever seen, I think. But, like, the kind of, like, flat space of this, like, simulacra is kind of like I was really, like, caught by the fact that the photographer in this one, he's not, like, they missed a trick, right? This is the perfect movie to sell you something. This is the perfect movie to give him a brand new Sony or a Canon and get a couple, like, glory shots of that so you go out and buy one, because for some godless reason you want to be, like, a character in Irish Wish. But he's using, like, an old Nikon that you can get on eBay, like, $200-$300. And, like, so this movie is, like, it's, like, trying to, like, affect something. It's desperately trying to, like, code things and signify them and get them to slot into the human mind. But if you look at the reviews of this, like, I don't think anybody liked this movie on Earth that wasn't being paid to say that they liked this movie. Or maybe somebody who volunteers at the Des Moines Travel Board. Maybe they genuinely like this film. But, like, I think, like, is the question I will posit now to the group. Is there some kind of, like, I don't know, heightening contradiction that's stressing the fuck out of the simulacra with this one? Are we reaching some kind of, like, sauce breaking point here? discuss.
I kind of have a bleak answer, which is like nobody liked it, but it's not going to make any difference anyway. Like that doesn't matter.
Oh,
anymore.
No, yeah, yeah.
Right, like yeah. You don't have to make like because cultural production is so monopolized, it's so relentlessly focus grouped, and it's so algorithmically targeted. Even if you didn't like this movie, you watched the movie anyway, right? Or you absorbed it like secondhand, miasmatic cultural impression. Right.
So are you saying that we are part of the problem?
Like, no, because at least we're trying to be like the existence of Irish Wish is a symptom of something to go to right. What you're saying. Like it's something there's something quite heroic about pointing the Nikon camera out and like, can we find anything authentic here? Can we find like just the smallest thing to like dig our fingers into and hold on? It's like nobody liked this movie, but that doesn't matter. Like. It doesn't matter anymore. And there's going to be like 9 more of them. They're already in pre-production because these platforms have consolidated. They've sought to cut labor costs. They've sought to cut production costs. They've sought to cut writing costs to the bone. It's like people always like make fun of the Adorno meme about, you know, every time I go to the cinema, I come away feeling more stupid. but it's like, I understand that now, right? Because the kind of critical content of art as an idea, you can't find it here. Looking for it will break you.
There's no order to the sort of like collection of objects anywhere mm-hmm. in on the interior or the exterior of the movie. And from the exterior perspective, right, like it's a Netflix movie. You don't go see it. It's just there. It just kind of pops up. It's a phone notification at the most. And then everything else is just the kind of like ephemeral. Just as you're saying, John, the goal at least is not to get people to watch your thing anymore. It's to get people to talk about it on social media. There are television shows like some people like dry workplace comedies like The Office. I watch a lot of TV. You know, I don't have any qualms with anyone liking a television show. But that television show, Abbott Elementary, is the perfect example that I can think of that, which I know, like, I don't, streaming numbers are also very ambiguous too. Netflix doesn't share their streaming numbers, for example. So
deliberately,
they lie.
Yeah, exactly. You're strung across this, like, it's harder to even sort of wrap your head around how people count how something is popular anymore. And that shift has moved away towards the mimetic, which is also mediated by an adjacent communicative apparatus. And then that trickles all the way down into the particular content of this film, because pointing out the Nikon, he's shooting on a Nikon D3100 mm-hmm. from 2010 and driving a perfectly preserved 1964
yes!
coupe convertible. What the fuck?
We have to talk about the car.
The car.
We have to talk about the car.
Mm-hmm. It's unbelievable. It is something that can only be owned in real life by a rich collector asshole who leases out their stuff people to mm-hmm. use in movies. That is the only possibility where anyone who takes pictures of Bolivian tree lizards or sheep shearing festivals can actually afford to drive. There's no, like, again, this order of objects. He dresses kind of like a catalog's version of, like, kind of an arty straight guy. I have one of the shirts that he wears in the movie. I'm like, oh, man, there's a shirt. There's a shirt that I own. It's this very standard, very kind of like catalog sheen version of things. And then placed just in perfect order is this series of objects to affect a particular character. But the second you look, if you know anything about the objects that are placed mm-hmm. in this order, now I'm rambling about the camera and the car because they don't make sense and they're right next to each other the whole fucking movie. And I'm like, wait, this doesn't make sense.
Semiotically, it's just like completely broken. It's like we said that right. this film doesn't mm-hmm. like you as a viewer, and it's like, the film's content doesn't like you as a viewer. The film's production doesn't care about you at all. Because, like, culture, like, in the period of, like, the late 20th century, that was when film, like, culture was produced as a commodity for a consumer basis, right? That's not how or why culture is produced anymore. It doesn't, mm-hmm. like, it genuinely doesn't matter if you didn't like this movie. It genuinely does not matter. You have, like, the kind of liberal answer to the problem of like cultural alienation onto capitalism is to go, well, you just vote with your dollar, you just don't watch it. it doesn't matter. They'll keep just like churning the handle on the machine of this endless recombinatory mechanism that will just like knock out another one and another one and another one until the very conception of what culture is or could be gets boiled down to the romantic comedy industrial complex.
Netflix. Culture will just be reducible to Netflix as an image.
Yes. The logo.
As this kind of...
Just the logo.
It's a phantasmagoria. It's a projection, an arranged projection. Those, like... But now it's been traced and then painted, and then the painting came to life, and it's telling me to visit Des Moines, and I can't figure out why. It's my sleep paralysis demon is the phantasmagoric image of this movie traced, colored, and come to life, and it said, visit Des Moines, be a high school principal, don't fall down, you know?
But you will.
All the time. So much falling. They trip over everything. And she drops things. Actually, it's really interesting. What really set, again, tinfoil hat moment, what really set me off is when I rewatched it and I noticed that very important scene when she first arrives at the absurd manor.
Are you talking about the vase moment?
Yes. Yeah. When she almost knocks it over, but catches it at the last minute. And obviously it's two shots cut together from two different takes of it, which is also really funny because the timing is just off. But like that moment right there, I went, oh, that's actually a really, really important moment to the content of the movie.
Yeah. Everything about this film, I feel, is like dyschronically timed. Nothing is happening at not the right moment. And even in the kind of like, okay, if we accept the onboarding of like the cishet patriarchal colonial white supremacist messaging of Irish Wish, even to the internal logics of that timing, like nothing in this movie is kind of like happening as it should be here in like massive quotes. And I think like so much about what we watch everyone doing in this movie is kind of the most like there's like a rancid like The smells like burning engine grease is like watching this movie. It's like we're watching Netflix trying to like, oh, Lindsay Lohan's a known name, that's gonna sell. We're kind of the new home of these like Hallmark center right, slightly right leaning rom coms. Let's just churn out more, and they can't even like stick the landing. It's like shrinkflation. Nothing lasts anymore. We can't repair anything. There's this kind of like ultimate economic degradation. And here we're watching it in like a direct to video where it's just all of her friends and family show up on screen and they get to drive around in cool cars and play with stuff they like, try on clothes and go home.
And all you get to do is you get to watch. And that's it.
At least the Adam Sandler movies will piss on us. At least they let us know they hate us and they're not trying to pretend to be our friends.
It's really bad considering all of the labor conflict that's been happening. In the industry too. That combined with this sort of like the sort of string of premonitions that have come through movies like this popping up on Netflix and all of Netflix's like profit issues and like there's a, like the all the stuff that's been holding this sort of cultural transition up is not just precarious. It's like it's not even Potemkin, like, right? It's not trying to like sell its own validity. It's just like a crumbling mess, and it just doesn't bode well for any aspect of it. Like it's gonna get farmed out and stripped for parts more and more as time goes on, and it's so encompassing that it's we're just not gonna notice it. There's all the free time that is normally filled is getting progressively filled with mundane activities. You know, between, you know, scanning your groceries at the checkout, to like the sort of micro video, like pivot to like micro video content, that just sucks up and sponges up so much additional time. that, like, you know, this is, it's the cure. It's, this is like the next sort of turn in the cure to boredom thing, the sort of Fisher, the Fisher point, I think. And I think that's what's really bad, because that's a, one of the, that's one of the most important, I think, diagnostic points he made, was like the, was the checkout robots, right? The, like, it, it's marketed as this convenience, but in actuality, it's farming off the most mundane portion of the task, to the consumer. In reality, it's spread, it's further spreading out and disassembling the productive apparatus. And, yeah, everyone's just going to be delivering each other's food in 10 years or whatever.
What if you made an Irish wish and everyone came? Boom. My joke of the day, everyone. Please.
Like clap. I know maybe people listening are like, we're massively overthinking this. It's we're all getting to,
but someone
getting,
has to.
But you have to. And you, and like,
but you have to get worked up.
We have to, because otherwise, like, people will, like, it's the naturalization of it, which I hate. Like this idea of like, well, what did you expect? What did you expect? For it's a Netflix rom-com. What did you expect? It's like, well, this is just the way things have to be. And I'm like, I'm so glad you brought up Fisher, because it's like my favorite Fisher quote is just from an interview, and I can't even remember which interview it is, where someone goes like, oh, some people say that you're a miserablest, or like you don't want anything to change. It's like, it's not that I hate change. I just wish it wasn't all shit.
Exactly.
Like, does it have to be like this? Is this truly what we want? Is this truly what we want? And the answer has to be no, because this has no desire within it. It's a completely empty object. And the desire is always the desire to be desiring, right? That's always what it is. It's not like some innate thing that it's responding to. It is trying to teach us how to desire through the mechanism of the visual image. And it's like, you don't have to want this. You can want something else.
And like, even if you love Lindsay Lohan's filmic career, even if you are compelled and hypnotized by these shitty rom-coms, as I am. I watch all of those Mar Vista movies, right? Like, I am not immune to this stuff. I enjoy it. Even if there's stuff in this very movie that you found compelling, this should be a nauseatingly enraging film to watch. Because even if you like all of this stuff, this is what is being served to you by the kind of machinery of capital. Right? We're like lining up like hogs to the trough, and they're going like, they're not even going, is this good? Do you like this? Should we try something new? Like I enjoy Lindsay Lohan as an actor. Like, I think, like, barring this film, I think, like, she could do some beautifully weird romantic shit, but like kind of doesn't happen very often. And like, even like this, like this movie is a betrayal of what it means to be human. Butlerian and Jihad win.
It's not even like funny when it's trying to be funny. It, like, humor is like devoid of humor. It's the it's just a representation of humor. This is the funny thing happening, and that's why
just simulacra all the way down.
Yeah, it really has like no internal, like, and I mean, and this is where, like, it's the obvious point, right? The rom-com genre lacks its own internal criticality. Because it can't disrupt, like, it relies too heavily on deeply embedded, like, wishes and no wish pun intended this time, wishes and fantasies of a lot of people. And it can't disrupt it. Like, even though those people, you know, oftentimes you hear people like, this is my trash TV. I know it's stupid, but I like it. Or, you know, that sort of a thing. It's so bound up in that it's doing everything it can to try and, like, sort of, like, spawn off and do something new, but it's just not working. And so we're getting these kind of, like, horrifying experiments, like, of that, just like that, yeah, these kind of, like, soulless, like, constructions that don't come to life at all. Just like, you know, it's a collection of limbs pushed down a hill. like, it's not a direct contrast, but I was trying to think of, like, What's an example of something more contemporary that exercises a kind of criticality of its own ideas and maybe the, like the, and even in kind of like a postmodern way and the sort of like genre conventions and that sort of a thing, and actually makes a good fun movie that's interesting to watch. And I watched the movie Bottoms the other day for the first time, which was very deeply funny, silly, exercised a kind of criticality of its subject matter in a whole bunch of really absurd ways between, you know, very famous professional football players being cast as teachers to the entire cast being between the ages, I looked it up, between 22 and 27 playing 17-year-olds. But it's not asking people to accept that as a reality, but it's asking them to accept that as a humorous deformity of, it's a movie about a high school where everyone openly talks about fucking each other. Like literally on the announcements, like they have bullhorns and they use profanity. There's only one teacher, seemingly. There's no other teachers besides Marshawn Lynch. Like Marshawn Lynch seems to be the only teacher in the school. There's a teacher and a principal. But it's a really good movie. It's a good story. It just had like, it used a lot of really good talent to do an absurd like high school sex movie. That at least like, yeah, again, I'm not going one for one. Like we're in some ways talking about apples and oranges, but like it in other ways, it's just, there are places that you can look for something that is like, oh yeah, movies can be fun and silly, can exercise a kind of criticality, on their own, internal conventions as well as, you know, on the, it's a very queer movie that like, some of the characters are really good people. Some of them are really bad people who make a lot of mistakes. Like they're, you know, it makes no apologies for anything and doesn't preach at you. And like, it's a comedy. It has a lot of, there it is. The answer is that it has a lot of joy in it. It takes a lot of joy in making art. And that's why it's like, it's not a perfect movie, but it was a lot of fun to watch. Joy is important.
This is going to sound so weird, but this is precisely why I wanted to talk about Max Payne. Because like like Max Payne is a complete cliche. It's a complete like everything about it. But like Max Payne's face in the first film, in the first game, that's Sam Lake. That's the writer and director and star. And like it's just pictures, photographs put onto like a cheap model, and it's like it's so kind of insubstantial in a way, but there's such kind of genuine joy in going through these old familiar routines and gestures that it becomes kind of transformative, you know, that moment of like you know, it's, and like the other character models are just like people who worked at Remedy or were friends with him and like it's this, it's goofy and it's very silly and it's very like, it's very, very cliched, but it's made with exactly that, with the, like the joy that only comes out of human agency that you recognize, you only recognize it by its absence. And like you sort of spiritually recoil from that absence.
I think like, I'm so happy we're talking about Max Payne and Bottoms. Absolutely. And like this idea of like, you know, trash TV and like the comfort food of the artistic world. Because I think like something I was thinking about while watching this is like, we're in a pop cultural moment, and I think a broader cultural moment where like anti-intellectualism has, we have ceded all grounds to that and has largely won a lot of very important like sites of cultural conflict. You know, the like, oh, now that I'm an adult, I could buy all the things I wanted when I was a kid and watch all this like stuff and not have to think about anything. And like, oh, when I watch this, I do so completely uncritically. Mm-hmm. And then like you get these kind of like little cystic nightmares, like Irish Wish coming out of that exact same attitude. And what it was like the, we kind of talked about Company Towns briefly for a second. And like I was thinking like, you know, like there's like a bygone affect that was forced on the working class where it's like, oh, well, of course rich people have nicer things. They earned it. They pulled themselves up by their bootstraps and one day you could do it too. And like, we've kind of like, I feel like we've shed a lot of that weight. Like nobody looks at rich people today and they're like, wow, you really earned that $70,000 watch. You're so cool. But like culturally, I still feel like we have a lot of that attitude baked into us that like we, the working peoples of this earth, deserve the Irish wish slop that's foisted upon us. And it's only for like fancy people to have like critical art that cares and thinks and feels. And that's like, ah, God, like this movie makes me so fucking mad.
It's an elite removed from class. Precisely. It's an elite in affect. It's happening in a pincer effect, right? On the one hand, I don't want to explore the causality too deeply here because I might go further insane, but the like it's the is it Warren Buffett who does the he lives in the same fucking house he's lived in for however long, and like there's a kind of like there's a dressing down of wealth out of this knee jerk like kind of almost not an knee-jerk instinctual understanding that like the sort of ostentatious and opulent like way of living can't be represented by direct wealth in the way that it used to be. Look at Donald Trump, right? Donald Trump is still kind of all about that kind of life, but it's not about his it's not just because he's in politics anymore. He's a rich guy in perception and understanding, and the opulence is funneled into his supporters, which is where it's embodied in the the Florida Trump like store. There's this phenomenon where like it's like a store. You'll just be in a strip mall, and there will be a store, random decent sized storefront that just says Trump on it, and it's just filled with MAGA merch. It's like a pop-up shop for MAGA merch or whatever. And there's these things are all over Florida. I've seen a shit ton of them. I've never been inside of one, though that would be fun. But I don't want to be around any of those fucking people. It has this like it's like in our sort of like personal like tinkering of extravagant imagination has yet again disrupted the like configure how the ease of seeing the configuration of wealth. What about this fucking movie? What's the class configuration in this movie?
Yes.
Who makes what and who works for whom and what is the nature of those all those relationships are social removed of all class aspect. Like, not to say that like she needs to become an Irish Republican. Like well, she should at the very least, but like, I don't need that to be in the movie. But like, it's just another component of like, no one works for anybody. And then like, there are rich people, but it's not about them being rich. It's about them being particular. Rich people are particular and want things to be in a certain way because they need to be in control. It's not because the wealth directly signifies the good thing. It's laundered through all of this other like. Rich people are just this kind of like personified category.
Yeah, they literally have
an actual
a butler.
Social
they
category.
Literally have
yes.
a butler. Like,
yes,
he's a novelist.
But like, you're completely right. Like, what is the vanishing mediator? The thing that actually gives coherence to subjective experience under capitalism. Is not something that is sublimated into cultural signifiers or like consumptive products. It's class relationships. It's not like you need the film for them to like become an Irish Republican or like, but like an awareness of the fact that like these things, this determines social relationships. Like, and try as you might with like your Veblen-esque luxury good of free time now, because really this is what the gig economy has sold us, right? It's the idea of to be rich is not to have relationship to capital, it's to have time, and we're going to give you time back. But that isn't working anymore, because really ultimately the extraction can only go on so long before the bottom falls out. So it's like, yes, the reason that like this film like feels spiritually sick is precisely in its like determined like obscuring of that very simple foundational truth that everybody recognizes about their life.
Hello?
You're back.
My phone
died. It was perfect. It was seamless. It was seamless, and that was all John.
I mean, my phone didn't die. I Irish wished for a brief second that I wasn't a podcaster, and then I learned a valuable lesson and became a podcaster again.
The genie St. Bridget passed behind you, and yeah, a very attractive person appeared.
Because this is the other thing, isn't it? You can't learn. You can't change. You can't, like, this is like the emotional affective flip side of economic capitalist realism, right? Can you mm-hmm. try and become something other than what you already are? No, like, you're fated. There is no freedom. There is no agency. There is no, isn't this one of Zizek's few good points, this idea of like love without the fall, right? Yeah. To fall in love is to risk, right? This is what makes it so beautiful and so painful and so incredible, is because sometimes the risk pays off. But it's like, this is a film where like you can literally fall into the car and that's it. Right, there is no longer any risk. There is no longer any possibility of like of growth or of change or of difference. Everything just is.
It's the exact argument, yes, that I'm currently trying to make in a chapter right now, which is this idea that the risk assessment is something that's been necessary for oppositional elements to be able to, it's been conveyed through their relationship with various laws, right? On the one hand, you have laws that, like, say you are an anti-war demonstrator in the Vietnam War. Scratch that. Let's go back to the 20s. Say you are, or the teens. Say you are a left-wing agitator in opposition to World War I. You're going to get locked up under various laws. The Espionage Act and the Sedition Acts were imposed for just as such. The resulting change in, one, people's perception of what they're able to do, and on the other hand, the law itself, come into this sort of like process of evolving social change to where categories of what it means to be a certain type of a person become embedded in the legal progress that's pretty much always aided by capital. You can see that in vagrancy laws also, for example, like the evolution mm-hmm. of the vagrant as a social category. And then you see it happen again in the 1960s, where the people who got there were plenty of people who got locked up for resisting the draft resistance. Draft resistance being not exactly the same thing as draft dodging. There were some state laws and federal laws that were passed to sort of expand the prohibition of burning draft cards and stuff. And this combination of sort of like this like interwar, this like stretch from World War I past World War II up to Vietnam, there were these changes that were made that were like not enough to prohibit people from striking out in illegal opposition to the war. So some people went to jail and some people didn't. Through the rising public opposition to the Vietnam War, fewer and fewer people got locked up. The initial goal was to overwhelm, so it's to do something very similar to what the IWW used to do, which is to use the law, breaking the law, to overwhelm the legal system to where they can't lock up everybody. That's still technically true, although there's been this evolving sense of change and this increased sophistication that, and this is the point that I wanted to make, that becomes embedded to where legal change isn't necessary. And that's what happened after draft resistance in the Vietnam War. Eventually, the public perception shifted as well to where laws didn't necessarily needed to be. By the time the public had come out in opposition against the war, the sort of legal discursive apparatus or whatever, it realized that it wasn't really necessary to lock people up for this anymore. So you see convictions for draft resistance going down. And then eventually it just doesn't really why is that something that doesn't happen anymore? America has fought wars. It's not just because we don't have a draft. It's because the evolution of the lack of a necessity for the draft was bound in the evolution of draft resistance itself. So they both go down. And that's because there's been a shift in perception of what people are capable of doing, right? Like it historic, and then we also now have all these sort of like historic images of draft dodging, you know, hippies, you know, burning their clothes and just doing drugs and running away to Canada, which is not how it happened. There's a sophisticated group of people who organized in direct opposition with all these other elements of the call it the anti-war apparatus or whatever, that found a lot of success. But then the reaction to that is this, like, shift in the perception of what will happen and what people are capable of, in a way that, like, it's a deeply, deeply historical thing. And this is, like, for better or for worse, I think, as we've probably said, it's changing again. So our relationship with, I'm going to use that trailing off as an opportunity to, I don't know. That's it.
Yeah. No, I think this is so important to, like, that shift in perspectives of the limitation of what is possible, I think, is so important, both as, like, a broader commentary to what's going on in Irish Wish. This film is nauseatingly ignorant of any kind of political complexity, even to the smallest degree, right? Like this film posits a world in which the only friction is, can your mom get to the Des Moines airport in time? And even that is mostly because this movie needed some, like, boobery and some farcical comedy. But, like, you know, like, and I think, like, there's this kind of, like, impulse here to treat Ireland as, like, this blank monolithic space. Like, this is a vision of Ireland as purely colonized. You know, there is nothing there besides, like, you can go, a bunch of non-Irish people can claim it and go visit as tourists. But I think, like, the back end of that is also true, right? There's, like, a temptation to, like, reduce the political complexities there to just, like, I don't know, easy jokes about the IRA or something, rather than talking about, like, the housing crisis, the rightward political drift, like, yeah. Ireland's position between the UK, the EU, and the United States. Ireland making the really bold political stance recently to back Palestine, which is bucking the trend in Europe. And, like, all of that is going on, and Irish Wish comes out on... So St. Patrick's Day, like... is like I saw a bunch of MAGA people like doing, like, Trump scavenger hunts on St. Patrick's Day and, like, taking pictures in front of Trump Tower and stuff like that. And it's the most, like purely aestheticized politics, right? There is no core here. And yeah, like, just, like, your point, Kyle, here was so fucking strong. And if Irish Wish can do us anything, it is that gift of the kind of nausea and anger necessary for movement, right? Like I'm sick and I'm mad and I don't want to be here anymore.
There's just two very quick things, like, which is, like, to absolutely underscore what you're talking about, Ash, is, like, there's a moment where Maddie goes, yeah, we went to the Cliffs of Moher, and somebody goes, why would you go to that tourist trap? Nobody else is there. Like, nobody else is there when they're doing that. It's empty. Nobody else exists. Like, I watched this movie on the very same day that I read in the Irish Times fucking amazing essay by the novelist Sally Rooney, who's maybe one of the best political essayists alive in the world right now, talking about the Irish government's approach to the Israel-Palestine nightmare, going that, yeah, okay, Ireland criticizes the actions of Israel, but Leo is going to the White House and is not going to speak up to the U.S. government because it's been such a good friend to Ireland. And it's like, it's an essay that's so good to read after watching this film, because you recognize what does the actual drive to change, to see something new emerge, look like, to come from the site of cultural production, right? A novelist rather than a filmmaker. Like, it doesn't, like, this is the whole point, right? This is everything that we've been saying, is, like, it doesn't have to be like this. Like, it doesn't. Like, if you want your comfort, you want your trash, that's fine, but you deserve something better. Like, just this is insulting to you. This is the, and it is necessary to find the capacity within ourselves to start with the, like, utmost rejection of this that is slowly kind of like coating our horizons of possibility with nothing but like the worst gray sludge that's taken as just like geologically immutable.
Yes. Yes. I'm, oh my God. Like we're so, okay. So welcome to Horror Vanguard's Contemporary Politics Hour. So what was it, one day ago when the Irish Prime Minister Leo Varadkar, I might be saying the last name wrong, did that handshaking session with Biden, you know, the St. Patrick's Day drag out the Irish PM to the United States so we can parade them around. And like, but you know, like he did say like, oh, we need the bombs to stop. He did chastise Biden for like, you know, and not in words that should have been said, but for like effectively like using this Irish aesthetic that Biden likes to trot out without having like a broader political sense of what the responsibilities behind that would be. And I think like Biden is the Irish wish president. Like he is that like aesthetic skin suit covering this kind of like greasy capital machinery. And like by that extent, like that shouldn't be to like, oh, like, you know, parade one of these politicians before the other as like being less of an Irish wish, less of a skin suit. But like instead, like it should be exactly that, to like fill this kind of like drive for potential. Like because this space is so flat, because everything is in such a cultural heat death right now, like that just means that like the raw potential of what can be new now is increasing to the extent that the new is dying and disappearing from the surface of the world.
Yeah, I think we have to continue to put art at war with consumer products while not not get consumed in the sort of like some neo adbusters kind of like we've all been victims of. Raise your hand if you've ever been victimized by adbusters. We've all been there. If you're a certain age and politically left wing, we all know adbusters. But it's not about that. It's about the politicization of ideas in a way that allows for some measure of countercurrent, right? Like art needs to go to civil war, you know, with the revisionist, defamatory non-art that pervades every sort of like, you know, personally, I've kind of made this my personal goal. I don't know why, is to illuminate the slop or whatever. I just think it's, you know, one thing that and it's something that Horror Vanguard does well is that it refuses to neglect something because it's popular as a vehicle for pretension. Like it's not about like even being critical of something that's has a sense of like, you know, like that's familiar to popular culture isn't enough. You have to have you have to exercise a certain criticality that goes beyond the, I don't know, fucking What amounts to criticism these days is, you know, a YouTube channel that, you know, counts things, basically. That's the, which again is very, is very sort of like computer mechanized criticism, right? Like how many things look bad in the movie? Let's count them on the screen. And I'm just like, oof, this is bleak.
Yeah.
I couldn't agree more.
I want to maybe finish with like a reassuring point, which is like this is not a new problem, and like there is, you're probably thinking this already, but like one of the thinkers who is like in the HV canon of like doing theory correctly, is Walter Benjamin. What is the response that we were talking about? It's very simple. This is the situation of politics which fascism is rendering aesthetic. Communism responds by politicizing art. That is precisely the imperative, like not even like a necessity now, like the imperative, like the political imperative of like if you take the project of like emancipatory leftist politics, capitalist politics seriously, that you have to be able to look at this and like recognize beyond the aesthetics is a deeply like kind of repugnant politics, and the only way of like as you say, there has to be the war of art against the consumer object. And again, this is not like a return to some sort of traditional notions of like high art versus right. like popular culture, but simply mm-hmm, to mm-hmm. recognize that like, or even like, you know, trying to rehabilitate this concept of aura because the means of and yeah. technological production of art has changed so rapidly, but simply to recognize that there is a kernel of truth to the work of art in the age of mechanical reproduction, and its politics is accelerationist, right? Accelerationary. Right, those impulses and tendencies and symptoms that Benjamin noticed a century ago are multiplicitous and like racing onwards at the speed of technological development, and so that's the only way of responding. Like, we live in Irish wish world, and this is hell. Nor are we out of it, but we could be.
I'll be brief, I promise. The filmic foil, I just figured out. And Ash introduced it in the beginning. The foil to this film is the movie Happy Gilmore, which I recently rewatched. And yeah, it's not perfectly preserved by the stretch of time necessarily. But Happy Gilmore is a movie about class politics in a very mm-hmm. like intensely personal and deeply relatable way, about a guy who has a dream of being a professional hockey player, but he's just not good enough. And who kind of finds himself in this class war with country club assholes as he competes to change and like popularize the very sport that they love through this kind of like rowdy, disruptive, by partying harder than everybody else. This very classic 90s like trope that has, I'm sure, you know, many, many deeply recessive problems. But however, when it's placed in that sort of like configuration, a very explicitly class-based configuration, there's some real like magic in a comedy. There's a romance in that movie, and that attempt that like shows that attempts to move someone, and it's not someone becoming rich. It's the opposite. It's mm-hmm. it's the golf lady like being charmed by the guy who actually knows how to have a good time. And I think that's really fucking underrated. I was surprised. I randomly rewatched it when I was staying with my family when it was on TV. And I watched it and I'm just like, oh, this is a movie about class and it's also good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Hell yeah. The Price is Wrong, Bob. good movie. Good movie. But no, even so, like I guess the last thing I want to say is like, we've brought up so much today, kicking around this kind of like Lovecraftian madness generating tome of a film. And I think like my last thought here is like, it would be, God, like, and this is kind of speaking to like Kyle, your point on like the cinema sins of the world, right? Like the kind of what passes for film criticism these days, where it's just like lists of things that are perceived to be incorrect and then lists of things that are perceived to be correct. And I think like, you know, part of the process here is like, even with a movie like Irish Wish, or like with literally anything, right? With Adam Sandler movies, with the work of Walter Benjamin, with like, I'm looking at my board game collection right now and I've got the copy of Thirsty Sword Lesbians. Even with that, like with literally everything, is to like levy criticism against it, find those little sites of contradiction inside of them, and use that to help move yourself and the world forward. Right, this isn't about like, oh, we're not like moralizing this. We all watched this fucking movie.
Right.
At some point in my life, there is a non-zero chance I watch Irish Wish again. Yeah, you know, like this isn't creating like the perfect moralized taxa of acceptable films for people with agreeable left politics. It's about recognizing that like there is no escaping the gravity well of colonialism, classism, racism, misogyny, all of that. You know, like the way out isn't this like simple teleology of like building a staircase out of good and pure things that you can like, I don't know, climb your way out of exclusively.
Yeah, that's kind of the point of all of it. Be ruthlessly critical. It's fine.
Yeah, there's a neat turn of phrase there.
Yeah, I thought of it myself. I came up with that.
Well, we have certainly had fun today with our new host, the new host of Horror Vanguard, one Kyle Kern. Kyle, how does it feel to be on Horror Vanguard for what is the seventh or eighth time, maybe the ninth? but also in a very important way, for the first or also maybe second.
Well, when you put it that way, I think it's perfect that we watched this movie. No, I feel very good. I Know Who Killed Me was my pitch. My appearances have been a combination of pitches from both sides. But I first proposed that we cover Lindsay Lohan body swapping in the first place. And the fact that that ended up here is very special to me. So thank you. Can't wait for more. I'm very excited for a certain other movie that we're going to cover next. That a horror movie about edging. That I think is going to be really good.
Oh, there's no follow up joke to that. There's no good way to. Is there ever a good way to say goodbye, listeners? until we fall into the car of life together, until we find ourselves again in Ireland, praying to saints for non-political outcomes. Stay spooky.
There we go.
We hope you've enjoyed the Dread Discourse. Until next week, stay spooky.